Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name is Jolyon Rubinstein.
My name's Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation. Hayden, what is News Roast?
No one's ever so, News and Roast is a discussion which doubles up as a metaphor in which we have three courses of conversation where our guest brings on all three things for us to chew on. Someone's just come through the door.
It's a crazy away day here.
It's okay.
Coffee being delivered. It's insane.
We're on location again.
We're on location in the Hospital Club in London, which is a super cool place. I'm having coffee in a very kind of metropolitan
location of our guest's choice.
Yeah, like, well, I say our guest, more like our kind of hostage. I basically did hassle Disney. This gentleman as if I was I mean, it was like a psycho ex-girlfriend. I literally did say to him in one twist of my head,
in a bush with binoculars and duct tape.
You think this is weird? You're going to be his wife this time next year. You two are being in a long-term relationship.
I mean, honestly, Lenny, I mean, do you think you could marry me or...?
I like your quiff. I think you've got the quiff of doom, so I probably will end up marrying you because I'm very
into quiff envious.
That's good.
I mean, Henry, into quiff.
It does. I mean, we have kind of, you know, as it were,
we've bonded,
yeah. And I've already sort of spilt my load. But let me just give this the right big up. Well, because you know, we've already kind of introduced the guest without, you know, I've just told people how much I stalked.
Let's explain the concept first of all, which is three courses of conversation, and each week we bring on a new exalted guest. And they give us three different things to talk about. And I think this week is probably one of our most exalted.
I mean, certainly.
I mean, CBE, Sir, no less.
Yeah, I mean, let's just get this right, you know. Sir Lenworth George Henry,
woo!
No less, CBE, stand-up, actor, singer, father, television presenter.
Lenny, now that you're Sir and you like his quiff, is he obliged to tug his quiff? In front of you.
Well, I think some forelock tugging might be in action. If I had a quiff like that, I'd tug my forelock all day.
I don't have enough to tug.
And I think you know what I'm talking about.
I'm tugging about.
Tugging the forelock sounds like some strange thing in Lord of the Rings Gandalf would be dropping.
Yes.
I mean, look, this man only co-founded Comic Relief, you know, brush it off, no big deal.
No biggie.
Lenny, thank you so much for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm just hanging out in London. I'm supposed to be at work, but I'm playing hooky to be with you.
That is what I like to hear. He's bunking off, basically.
I'm bunking off work. Yeah. We like to think the news roast.
Yeah, we're thinking. We like to think of ourselves as the young cool kids, but you know, back in the old 1980s,
I feel like I'm on the park with my mates, and they're all smoking nicked fags.
Yeah,
man. I feel like I'm just bunking off school and having a nice time, and that's good.
That's exactly what
that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when the comic strip first started in the 80s, because like, what was your understanding of like that? Like, people talk about it as an alternative comedy scene, but you know, you were in the midst of it. Like, what was it like?
I was dating Dawn French at the time, who was a founder member of the comic strip with Peter Richardson, Nigel Planer, Rick Mayall, Alexia Sale, Jennifer Saunders, and the rest of them. And because I was a fan of Alexi, and I was on a television show called OTT with Alexi, which is a live sketch show on Saturday nights, and I met Dawn during that period, I was suddenly introduced to this world. And often when you're seeing someone, you're seeing the world through their eyes. And what I saw through Dawn's eyes and through Alexi's eyes was this opposition to traditional stand-up comedy tropes. And the common tropes were in Clubland, were the exotic and unknowable foreigner, the scary visible other, the kind of girlfriend with big boobs, the stupid Irish person, etc., etc., etc. And I was in the process of learning about who I was only 19 or something, but I was also split, because here I was in Clubland in the 70s in Great Britain, where somebody like myself was usually the butt of the joke, but I was also introduced to Richard Pryor at the same time. So there was this weird dichotomy of, here's one of the bravest human beings that ever lived, being forensically documentarian about his comedy and about his life and his lifestyle. And here's me in a land with Joss Williams and Sammy Thomas and Charlie Williams telling jokes about Pakistanis and Jamaicans and African people, and basically turning the blade of my own wit and intellect against myself. And what the comic strip and the alternative comedy movement were saying was, there's another way. And there's a way that's more self-supportive and self-nurturing. And I decided that I wanted to take that way. And with Dawn's help, and with Alexis' help actually, I was able to see that there are other ways to make comedy that don't involve burning your culture, burning your race and your ethnicity and your sexuality down, and bullying other people. It was a non-bullying way forward. And I just thought, oh my God, there's another way of doing this. Because I thought, Christ, if I'm in a club that's just white people and I'm the only black person, I better burn myself down comedically so that they know that I'm not a threat to them. Mm. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a kind of philosophy of attack me first before they do.
Yeah.
So once I'd taken all that in, and I'm never stop learning, so I'm a fast learner, I thought, this is what I should have been doing from the beginning, but I just had dodgy advice.
It's mad to think. So at the time, the sort of, you know, commercial populist comedy scene was like Jim Davidson, Roy Chubby Brown type humour. And that was what people were mostly watching.
But remember where we were, you know, 1974 wasn't very long after somebody got voted into council in Smethwick with the title, "If you want a nigger for a neighbour, vote Labour." That wasn't very long ago. So we're in the 90s, we're in 1974, which is like 8-9 years after that. So you've got to remember that this was a time of the black maid's legs in Tom and Jerry. This was people blacking up on telly. This was overt racism. You know, the Ugandan Asians coming into Britain. This was race riots in Brixton and in Birmingham. This was a time of fear of the other, fear of the xenophobic, horrific fear of people coming over here, taking our jobs, etc. And I grew up in that. And the comedy reflected that. So you've got to remember now, this is all post-ironic. People make racist and sexist and homophobic jokes and say, yeah, but I'm playing a character. Yeah, but I'm taking a stance about that thing. So therefore, I'm playing a character who espouses that thing so that you can wince and laugh ironically about that thing. Unfortunately, if you don't come out and go, I'm against that thing, people just think you're for that thing.
Yeah.
So. Sorry, I'm not making myself
No, you are. It's
but Warren, but when so with Alf Garnett, Johnny Spaeth, who's a brilliant writer, wrote Alf Garnett, who the writing was, I am against this thing. Unfortunately, the character was for those things, and all the people that are for those things in real life went, yeah, good old Alf Garnett. He doesn't like coons either.
Totally.
We were like, no!
Dale Maylin.
Johnny Spaeth's like the guy in Platoon. No! I'm making so much money from this, but no! I'm rich, but no!
Julian has this character called Dale Maylin, also this Tory called James Swattington Burbage, and we often find, like, genuine Tories will come up and be like, fantastic character.
Of course.
And then we're like, oh, fuck.
Well,
the mad shit with Dale Maylin was more like when I started realising, like, we were at the boat race absolutely just rinsing like poshos, and then the girls would be like, hello.
You're a very attractive man.
Because you're behaving
incredibly
like
rude and arrogant around those people. Arsehole. I find that incredibly sexy. And you just got this strange kind of vibe where, you know, I mean, I don't know if you heard that Malcolm Gladwell podcast, and he was speaking to Harry Enfield about loads of money. Mm. And you know, Harry Enfield was talking about the realities of trying to, like, take the piss out of the Nouveau Riche, and how Thatcher even would quote it as a kind of inference that this was not just socially acceptable behaviour, but now you've got a kind of comic a sort of symbol that sort of justified that that reality, and the sort of that white man van taking on. It's strange, isn't it? Why does that happen in comedy?
In comedy, because our art reflects life, and if the person that is reflecting looks at it and goes, yeah, that's me, it slightly undercuts what you're trying to do. Theophilus P. Wildebeest was supposed to be, Newsroast people, I did a character yonks ago called Theophilus P. Wildebeest, who was a soul singer.
I was just about to talk to you about
and
that.
And he was basically a sexist dickhead.
Come on, do the voice.
With a small penis. But unfortunately, when he did his thing, people sort of went, hey, and it was difficult. It was difficult for the people to separate the sexist dickheadism from the fact that a guy in leather pants was on stage singing a song about love.
I love it when
it was
just
really
dropped.
Weird.
Can people, I just say, I just got... When the octave just dropped,
the octave
just dropped. It was like,
Jesus, you two, get a room.
So it's tricky.
Yeah.
So it's tricky when you're doing that, but you've still got to do it.
Yeah.
So I think Steve Coogan did a character that was like that.
Yeah.
And when
Rick Mayall.
Sacha Baron Cohen does a character that is about one thing, it's very difficult because people are going, hey, you know.
It's funny, yeah. Borat's a funny one. You know, I met someone the other day.
Throw the Jew down the well. Suddenly,
I mean, it's, yeah.
You can have people go, do that.
Yeah. It's so weird.
No, I don't mean to do that. I mean, I'm making an ironic comment. I'm doing an ironic comment on. No. Yeah, do that thing you said you wanted to do. No, my comedy's going wrong.
In the news today, three Jews thrown down a well.
Hey,
we just did
job.
What Borat said.
Let's talk about a couple of your other characters. Let's talk about TP. Let's talk about the bad boy.
Theophilus.
Yeah, and obviously we've got to talk about Delbert.
Well, these are for millennials listening.
For millennials.
Theophilus P. Wildebeest was a soul singer in the same mode as, who would it be now? But I guess it would be Neo.
Yeah.
I remember Neo.
Yeah.
It's that the soul singer that has the rose and the... you know, the bed on stage for some reason.
A little bit Pharrell, though, you know, no?
No, it's
you
more...
Not?
It's more, and strangely, it's as dodgy as R. Kelly.
I was about to say.
I'm afraid.
Yeah. But just not in a closet.
Yeah, but it's the kind of soul singer who wears the leather pants and the codpiece and sort of wants to talk to the ladies all the time. But the joke about Theo was that he was infertile and couldn't get an erection or maintain an erection if he tried. And it was a very simple joke, a very blunt joke, but me and my writing partners thought, well, yeah, it's funny, these guys can't get it up because they talk about it so much. And as I said earlier, sometimes the joke backfires. I've been chased around the stage by hen parties doing this character. And so he's gone, no, you're not getting it. This is you not getting it. This is the epitome of not understanding the ironic content of this material. Please leave me alone. Please get off my car. So that was that. And then with Delbert Wilkins was an attempt to create a character, a bit like Coyote does, a bit like Mandem on the Wall, but to create a urban contemporary character that talks about things that are happening in the street. Today it would be Grenfell Tower or the riots in Dalston or Black Lives Matter, but in a kind of way that people from that community would understand. So Delbert Wilkins spoke like that. You know what I mean? He was a geezer off the street. He had things to say in the back of a car, but he also had a point of view about what was going down with the police. Black Lives Matter, you get me? Delbert was all about that. It was all about the people. Yeah. It was all about standing up to the police.
Yeah.
He said, do you have any identification? I looked in the mirror, I said, yeah, that's me. You know, Delbert was like that. And so he was very cheeky to the police. And now he'd be talking about, you know, we're 5 years or 10 years behind America. Delbert would be saying, how soon is it going to be before there's a Black Lives Matter movement here? I know it's started already, but we know, don't we, that the police are starting to make noises about the fact that they have to fill out so much paperwork before they get... I like the fact that they have to fill out a lot of paperwork before they requisition firearms.
Yeah.
I like the fact that there's a ton of paperwork before I give you a gun.
Yeah.
You know, I love that the police go, well, you know, I'll shoot you, but I've got to fill out 500 pages. Hang on a minute then. Right, nationality, British. Qualifications, 11 plus. Oh, I like that they have to do that. By the time they get to the end of filling out the paperwork, they go, do you know what, just don't do it again.
Just go. Yeah.
Just go home.
Yeah.
I know your mum. Mm. I like that. But in the meantime, how long will it be before a progressive Tory government who are really
red tape,
right, who say,
tape.
Slash and burn, let's get rid of the paperwork, they're all carrying guns, it's going to solve a lot of... How long is it going to be before
already.
That? And then the next thing you know, blam, some kid coming out of a nightclub.
But I live just next to Kingsland Road, and like watching that sort
y'all
of
need to move.
Mini riot the other night, and it was just a funny little thing because it was so contained. Like, it was three blocks.
Well, the red tape thing's happening already. I mean, that's what Grenfell was, you know. There were groups within Parliament, within the Tory party, that were pushing to get rid of the red tape, get rid of the red tape. It's good for business, good for business. It's going to happen in all areas.
Good for profit, good for profit. Yeah.
Listen, let's move on, because we've got so much to talk
about.
Yeah,
not much time.
First of all, we're going to talk about your first course, your little starter. Do you like a starter?
Yeah, I do. I like a starter. I tend to go for the main, but in the course of this metaphorical meal, I will indeed indulge in a starter. So here,
good for you.
Let's hear. What have you brought for us, Mr. Henry?
I've brought about comedy and charity. People are always asking about why did Comic Relief happen?
Yeah.
Mm. And why use comedy to raise awareness and raise money? And the first thing was, comedy is a reaction to things, always. You did your taking the piss out of poshos things because there's a prevalence, an over-prevalence of posh people in society running things and saying things that you disagree with. That's fair enough, I understand that. Back in the day when Comic Relief started, there was a real sense that, you know, the human rights thing with Amnesty, there was a thing for that, but post Live Aid, there wasn't a reaction to the Live Aid situation, which was people in Africa and also people in this country living beneath the poverty line, and who was doing anything to help. Comedians were doing small things to help. Everybody has their own charity. But there wasn't a big statement. And Richard Curtis went to Ethiopia, and he was basically shocked by what he saw there. He saw things that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he went in a room where everybody was dead, in a room where everybody was half dead, and in a room where people might survive. And the doctor said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm a comedy writer." They said, "Well, piss off and bring back a doctor. We need a doctor. We need medical equipment. We need food. We need inoculations. We need nurses. Come back when you've got that stuff with you." So Richard came back here and he went, "What do we do? I'm a comedy writer and a performer. Let's put on a show, because that's what we do." So he put on this show. Rowan Atkinson at the time was doing a rubber-faced review where he did Mr. Bean and various things. And he gave us his theatre for three nights. And everybody, if you'd been around at the time, you'd have been there, but everybody in comedy came along and did a turn. And it was the vibe was off the charts. The energy in that room of people wanting to do something good and not having to wag their finger and proselytize about it, but all you had to do was do your comedy and raise money. The vibe was brilliant. And, you know, for anybody, Rowan Atkinson was on it, the young ones were on it. Frances Saunders did Sex Talk, which is legendary now. I did Theophilus and Delbert and stuff. Jasper Carrot was on it doing he did weird insurance claims, and Billy Connolly did Ho Ho Ba, but everybody did their best stuff, and it was sort of legendary.
Yeah.
To be there, the feeling when you were there was electric. You were kind of goosebumps.
It was
in the 80s, before you guys were
back in the day.
You were kids.
Is it crazy now looking at it, this behemothic entity?
So that was the birth.
That was the birth of it, really. Yeah. So three nights.
A live series of shows. I didn't realize that.
It was filmed by Arena, and we raised £1 million. And then at my house, we had a thing at my house where we had drinks and stuff. And I just said, it should be on the telly. It should be an evening or something. Why isn't it on all evening? And why aren't we raising money like that? And Richard said, that's a good idea. And he organized it all. And we wrote letters to everybody in show business and said, would you be involved in an evening long comedy event that would raise money for Africa and the UK? And lots of people said no. But quite a lot of people said, yeah, all right. And all the people that were involved in the night said yes. So suddenly there was this thing called an evening of Comic Relief, and it was Red Nose Day. And with Richard's stewardship, and with me being the face of it, it became this big thing that it is today. And it's criticised for being far too big. But the takeaway from it is that comedy is a brilliant way of breaking down barriers. Mm-hmm. For people that don't understand something, the comedic way of explaining something by taking the mick out of it makes people go, oh, I see what you're doing. Yes, I get that. I understand that.
You couldn't have just put, I mean, what you mixed comedy and the serious stuff so well, and you couldn't have just put the serious stuff all evening on TV.
You just put people a bunch of depressing documentaries on all night.
Yeah, you'd have just, you know, you'd have,
that's
you'd have been in a hole by the end of the evening.
That's not going to work. Yeah. I mean, it's bad enough. Even now, people go, you know, charity porn, famine porn, they don't like it. But the fact of the matter is, it raises a lot of money. And I'm going to keep saying going forward, there's probably an argument about how brutal the documentaries have to be to elicit a response from the viewing public.
Do you think that's changed? Do you think people are a bit inoculated against that sort of stuff? They've seen so much.
I think people now want good news. I think people now understand what the problem is, but don't need to be battered over the head with it. I think there's a way in the future of telling the stories where instead of me or Chris Moyles or Simon Mayo or the girl from Love Island with a microphone in front of
much
somebody's
more
house,
to be the girl from Love Island now. Let's
you know,
be fair.
It, those people will represent themselves and tell their own stories. And I think that once you have people saying, look, I live here, this is what happened, please give us a hand, that will touch people and say, okay.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because, like, you know, Comic Relief is such a huge game changer. Like, I definitely remember growing up, and like the first time I really became aware of like the famines in Ethiopia and stuff like that was definitely through Comic Relief. Because I think it's just such a huge issue that, especially when you're a child, you know, it's also quite cool, isn't it? Like, oh my God, comedy's going on all night. We can stay up late, we can watch it, you know, everything
else.
Yeah,
and the type of comedy, the type of people that wanted to do this was sort of the kind of people that did quite edgy, transgressive comedy.
Yeah.
So actually, the pre-Watershed presentation of Comic Relief was always slightly problematic because, you know, in the first episode of Comic Relief, we repeated a whole episode of Dad's Army because we knew that people loved Dad's Army and we wanted them to stay with us and whatever. But now, because comedy is seen as edgy and transgressive and is BBC Three and Channel Four, BBC Two if you're lucky, there aren't that many mainstream big shot comedy programmes on mainstream television anymore.
But also,
hardly any on ITV.
Taking the sort of not contrarian point of view, but I suppose some people would argue, I mean, it's two things, isn't it? I suppose on the one hand, it's like what was incredibly edgy in the 80s sort of became the comedy establishment. Like, I don't think Comic Relief is like massively dangerous now. Like, it's not like that. Well, I see the early stuff. Like, I remember wasn't there something where you got in a lot of trouble for like talking in this way where you were making, like you were doing quite raw jokes about, and even when you did the thing with Colin Firth, like the King's Speech, like that was hilarious. But like, there's always the political correctness argument that comes in.
There's always that.
Because obviously then it becomes kind of, it's such a kind of stalwart of fundraising.
You have to be, I think our problem is that comedy is a multi-headed beast. And people like different things. And pre-Watershed, we have to cover the waterfront with
totally.
Stuff people like.
Yeah.
And every so often, a transgressive or politically incorrect or a politically transgressive bit of material will creep in pre-Watershed where people go, hang on.
Yeah.
This is outrageous. Whereas after 10 o'clock, nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know, so when Russell Brand comes on after 10 o'clock and does what he does...
That's Russell, yeah.
People go, yeah, that's Russell. Pre-Watershed, they sort of want Anton Deck and, you know, Mrs. Brown and their boys is quite transgressive.
It's huge,
but that's one of the most popular programmes on BBC One, so we have to go, here's Mrs. Brown and their boys, please give us your money. So my point, and I do have one, is that as a communicator and as a breaker down of barriers, comedy is the perfect tool because people are disarmed and then they go, oh, all right, I'll do this because you're doing it in a way that makes me feel good about myself and you're making me laugh and I'll join in. The problem is that comedy is incredibly subjective and not everybody likes everything. So you're going to piss some people off with it.
We had this conversation with John Lloyd, who created Spitting Image, who says that he feels that in some ways Spitting Image was a little bit of a release valve for people. So they did that instead of serious direct action or street protest. I do feel like there is a sense in which sometimes people feel as if, you know, there's a tokenism to all of this. It's like comedy is entertainment. You know, you watch Red Nose Day Comic Relief on the TV because you want to be entertained. And in some sense, and it's the same with our show, you can feel as if perhaps you're engaging in something when really you could be doing a hell of a lot more. And it's the same with, you know, this swing back to being politicized now with models wearing Grenfell t-shirts or, you know, Choose Love t-shirts, which was part of the charity that I'm involved in creating. And I think it's great that people are doing it, but you just bought a t-shirt. And sometimes people are buying the t-shirt off Amazon, which recreated the t-shirts, and we don't get any of the profits because they're buying it through the wrong fucking place. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, but they're wearing the t-shirt. And
it's comedy, like, yeah. It's fashion, isn't it? It's a weird thing. Like, sorry.
Yeah. Well, being political is fashionable, or becomes fashionable, or less fashionable. And I don't know. I think we need to expect a lot more of people.
I just think right now it's a really weird period of time, because I think in a way, right, you've got these kind of almost like this schism in the country. Like, obviously we saw it with Brexit and everything, but it's funny just talking about TV because, you know, like with Comic Relief, I think it's a really good example of an entity that obviously now employs a huge amount of people to make this kind of show that needs to obviously raise this amount of money. Never would have expected it 20 years ago, but now it's got to be expected. Can't be too edgy, because actually there's a huge amount of the British public, they're incredibly fucking conservative. And we're in this very strange time where you've got that, but also you've got this kind of bubbling away, this sense that, you know, things are kind of like need to be quite edgy again to really hit. Because as you were saying earlier, Haid, like, we have become so immune to images of death, war, famine, blown up bodies. Even that sarin gas thing with the Syrian kids, like, people, I saw people looking at it and they'd be like, oh, that's terrible. So did you see Love Island? Yes. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like a weird time.
Food.
Exactly. And there's a strange sort of like duality to that. So I don't think
we can, I mean, you sound incredibly sensible. And when you speak
really?
Like that.
You should know me better. I'm not sensible at all.
But what I mean is, we should celebrate the upsurge in political awareness in young people, because, my God, we've been waiting for it for a long time.
For
this vibe to come back. I'm very aware that there is a T-shirt buying public out there who will wear a Grenfell Tower Black Lives Matter T-shirt and not go on a march.
Yeah.
But we should celebrate the fact that people are more aware now, but because
the problem
for
is,
a very
I
long
totally
time
agree
they
with
weren't.
That.
Yes, but the problem is there's two sides of being more politically aware. Like, let's not forget that the people that voted Brexit and the Aaron Banks of this world, they consider themselves, you know, renegades. You know, he wrote a book called The Bad Boys of Brexit. He thinks of himself
making it into a fucking
as this
Hollywood
guy
film.
Who started a revolution and sort of, you know, we're in a fucking private members club here doing a nice podcast where we're talking about politics and stuff, but there's loads of other people out there who I see as quite regressive that think of themselves as the, you know, the new renegades and the new political
but the thing is, Lenny's totally right though, yeah, because the thing that we can't ever forget is that, you know, when we left uni, you know, the internet, like Facebook and stuff like that suddenly occurred, the rate of kind of that these ideas are proliferating online and sort of quite sort of like, you know, really progressive, really new thinking, it's hugely it's moving faster and changing people faster than it ever has before. But a lot of those people are not even yet a voting age. And when I saw, you know, the election result, you know, you do have a bit more hope, because you're like, and I think, you know, we've said this on the podcast before, but it's a bit like, you know, post-Brexit, I think a lot of younger people were like, fucking homophobia, racism, LGBT rights, you know, like basic sort of things that we imagined the left had won the cultural war. Oh, shit. Maybe we can't take those for granted. Yeah. Maybe like that stuff is just vanishing in front of us, you know. And they're like, right, well, fuck that. I'm going to take that back, you know, which is a great thing.
I think it is a great thing, and I think that Comic Relief, for good or ill, espouses a comedic and transgressive and communicative approach to right thinkingness. We're trying to say, look, you know, you can be part of something, and you can vote with your pound notes, you can support with activism. And I think maybe this is a result, you know, in a very small way, Comic Relief is responsible for people, for millennials going, I can do something. Whereas for a long time people didn't think they could do anything. They just thought, oh, it's just grown-ups,
yeah,
the people that run the world, yeah, running the world, and we're going to be the people under their watch, suffering from what they do. And actually, they've got the power to do something. And I think that with Comic Relief, it's please give money, please volunteer, please do something. And with politics, it's you can use your vote. You can vote when you're voting age. You can vote. You can.
Do you know you can vote. Do it?
You can vote. Oh my God, I can vote. I've got a vote. I can actually vote.
All these people in dictatorships looking at us, being like, what? 60% of you only show up for a. Are you mad?
Yeah.
Are you not mad?
I can vote.
On that bombshell, let's move on to the main course. What if we came round to yours on a Sunday, what's your like favourite thing to cook? Like, what's your, are you like a more of a chicken man?
I'm
or
a roast beef? Guy. I like a roast.
What
I like
kind
a,
of roast?
I like a news roast, but I also like a beef roast or mm. a, or a,
I find beef a big difficult. Chicken. I find beef difficult to keep it.
To keep it moist.
Moist.
You're yeah. going to go, boom, it's going to be fast.
Yeah, it
it's
does.
Basically just undercook it.
Yeah. yeah.
Just it's going like to be the
undercooked. I mean, yeah. and it's cooked. It, interestingly, it's still cooking when you take it out of the oven.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can undercook it, put it in the foil, leave it there, and when you're ready to carve, it's still lovely and pink inside.
What have you brought us for your metaphorical main?
Why is theatre and that important?
Why is theatre
I'm so
and
sorry.
Why is theatre and that?
It's so worthy. I'm so sorry. I can only apologise.
So you're saying the importance of theatre, and what are you specifically referring to? Because your roles.
What
you
I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is why is theatre important to people, and why is it important for us generally to have our lives reflected back at us so that we can think about it in a ordered, organized way? Because theatre is basically an encapsulated life lesson, if you like. Mm. Henry the Fourth, Part One, or you know, State of Play on the telly, or Othello. You know, these are kind of lessons for us to what the, you know, the Greeks used to pay the audience to come to watch something so that they get it. You know, theatre is for us to get, and it's supposed to reflect our lives back at us. And if it doesn't reflect all our lives, it's a problem. Mm. Which is why when the cuts are so swinging against local arts, local theatre companies that are unable to function because they haven't got enough money, it's difficult, because in that community, it might be the only place you can go to get something that reflects your life. So if you live in Hull or in Dudley or in Dunfermline, and if some local theatre company is doing a show about their community and they haven't got enough money to do it to the way they need to do it, that's a big loss for the local community.
Absolutely.
So when I went to the theatre when I was a kid, and I saw Panto.
Yeah.
I went with my mum's work. My mum worked at Holbert's factory. They made widgets. I don't know what they made. I remember seeing my mum at work once. And she was this lady, quite a big lady, dwarfed by this enormous machine where she pressed a button every 30 seconds and a loud noise went and this widget would be shot out the other end and go onto a conveyor belt, and then they did something else with it somewhere else. And that was my mom's job for years and years and years. But the works would put on a works do every year, and we'd go to the theatre to see a pantomime. And when I went to the theatre, I was immediately entranced by the socialness of it. Wow, this is an event, everybody's here. We're all looking at this thing happening on stage. There's lights, there's props, there's costumes, there's makeup, there's tricks, there's music. And I wanted to be part of that world, but I also thought, why haven't I never seen this before? I never saw a play, never saw a Shakespeare play, had Romeo and Juliet at school, but didn't know what it was. The guy didn't explain it was a play, didn't explain it was sexy, didn't explain it was as adventurous as Game of Thrones, but different and no dragons. It was just basically, read this because it's Shakespeare and you should. So, when my family came to see Othello.
With you playing Othello?
With me playing the lead. Mm. My sister Bev was incredibly moved by it, and she came into the bar afterwards and she said, Why have we never had this?
Never had what?
A family. Why working class black family in the
Midlands. Why have we never had this experience?
Why have we never had this experience before?
Right.
We've never been
so
to...
So it took you playing Othello for them to come and actually and see that.
But the problem is, when you see Shakespeare on telly, it's usually white people doing it.
Yeah, totally.
It's usually white middle class people doing it. And hey, a lot of my friends are white middle class, okay? Got no beef. But the problem is, when you see Shakespeare, it's usually a white guy in a blonde wig with a cabbage down his tight saying, how fee they for, they fee. You know, it's never done
Not that that's not amusing.
But it's only recently that we've seen a change where you see Adrian Lester playing Henry V. You see Don Warrington playing King Lear. You see Meera Syal and Sanjeev Bhaskar in Much Ado About Nothing. These are things where those kids from Commonwealth countries, the descendants of Commonwealth families, can watch that and go, that's me up there.
Yeah.
And that means I can do that. When you see yourself on stage, you go, I can do that, which is why, you know, when those kids watch The Establishment or Monty Python, they go, I want to do comedy too.
Of course, that's why.
Yeah. But if you're black and you live in this country and you're watching telly, like Riz says, you know, you see yourself running a corner shop or robbing a bank or slapping a geezer around the face. Mm. That's what you see yourself doing.
We were just talking about this outside, how basically Riz, when he gave his speech to Parliament, this is Riz Ahmed, said his sister, when he was a kid, he'd be like upstairs or whatever, and she'd just shout from downstairs, Asian, when she saw like an Asian person on TV, because it was so bad.
This is an occurrence for diaspora families.
Yeah.
If you're black and you see a black person on television, we would watch Love Thy Neighbour, even though it was racist at times, because Rudolph Walker was in it,
totally.
And he was our favourite, and in many ways he was advocating our point of view. Yeah. When you have something that represents you on television, you watch it and you support it, however terrible it is, just because the people involved with it look like you. So, for instance, you're watching working class people on television. It might not be good, but when it is good, like Boys in the Black stuff, you go, thank God. Yeah, somebody's telling our point. You know, somebody's talking about Thatcher's Britain. Somebody's talking about the miners' strikes. Somebody's talking about 4 million people unemployed.
Yeah.
Somebody's talking about the effects of that on a normal working class family. Thank God, Alan Bleasdale.
There's a big backlash against this now. I don't know if you saw in the last few days, Mary Beard was having this Twitter argument because everyone was outraged. All these people were outraged that there was this BBC cartoon, children's cartoon about Rome, and it had basically a black and mixed race family as a centurion and his wife and his daughter on this cartoon. All these people wrote in, oh, the PC-ness of this is absolutely ridiculous. There wouldn't have been any black Romans, which of course is complete fucking bollocks. And Mary Beard was saying absolutely rightly, you know, the huge part of Rome was in what, you know, they're Moorish, and they came over to, there were, you know, people who were like quite senior centurions in England at the time that were, you know, black Romans essentially. And I think we've, you know, there's this bizarre thing now that you can't, I think in a way we were a lot more open-minded, even in Shakespeare's, I was reading recently, even in Shakespeare's time, there were actually quite a few representations of black people in plays. I think Christopher Marlowe had some black people in plays. The evil people were always the Spaniards, because we were at war with the Spaniards because of the Spanish Armada and all that sort of stuff. But we were doing more trade with other parts of the Middle East.
I think there's always been, particularly in Elizabethan theatre, people were demonised or satirised because of their looks. There were different tropes. There was the kind of the Iago figure, there was the cuckold, there was the Moor, there was the Jewish person, there was the they had these tropes. So on representationally, there were these things that stood for something, and that was part of Elizabethan theatre. But now, when we've got many more people creating drama, creating comedy from lots of different cultures, we're still not seeing enough of that on our screens, on our televisions, on our stages. Mm. And as we've been trying to point out with the diversity activism that I do, that until the gatekeepers are more diverse, what we see will remain as undiverse as it's been for years and years.
It's actually quite shocking, that stuff.
You were quoted as saying, you know, I'm used to being the only black person wherever I go. There was never a black or Asian director when I went to the BBC. Eventually I thought, where are they all? I spent a lot of time on my own. Things have changed a bit, but rarely at the BBC do I meet anyone of colour in a position of power. And you were talking about that in relation to, you know, parallels between Othello, you know, and yourself.
Yeah, there was a huge parallel that I could use. Othello is isolated because he's in an environment of subtle Venetians who are clever and they know how to use language to get their own way, whereas Othello is a warrior. Mm. And although he's incredibly eloquent, he protests that, you know, rude am I in my speech. Well, I absolutely identify with that because I was working in a completely, almost completely monocultural environment for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
It's ironic because just outside there was a commissioner from the BBC that I met over 10 years ago now, who was a mixed race lady. She was the first person of colour I'd ever met in a position of power at the BBC. And when I walked into the room, I asked her when the commissioner was arriving, and she said, "It's me." And I went, "Ah, what are you doing here? How did you get this job? Who did you kill to get this job, et cetera, et cetera?" Because it was so unusual.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few more people in the industry.
But it's still...
in editorial and producerial positions. But it's still... a huge lack. And because of Ofcom's refusal to regulate behind the camera, behind the mic figures of employment, we're going to be in a terrible... Ofcom must regulate what's happening behind the screen. Mm. Otherwise, we're never going to know what's going on, who's got those jobs.
Like, let's be real, Lenny. Like, you're in a unique position to talk about this. Because, I mean, when I was growing up, like, you were pretty much the only black comic on television that was British. And you literally will go down in history as being, like, the trailblazer for black British comedy. But like, that's a huge yoke to carry, man.
But what's interesting now is... There's really good black comics now on the circuit, and Asian comics, Jemali Maddox and Ramesh and Dane and Gina, but they haven't got their own shows. They haven't got the opportunity to show diversity. When it's your show, you can start. You can say, "I want this to be diverse. I want there to be a diverse writing room. I want it to be diverse on the crew, and I want there to be a script editor that's diverse."
Yeah.
But until you've got your own show, you can't do that. And unless Ofcom regulate what's going on behind the scenes, it's never going to change.
But don't you think, in a way, there's...
It's always going to be someone's patronage that goes...
Well, that's...
Some guy from Oxbridge saying, I'm a left liberal. I think, obviously, this should be more diverse. Let's try and make a go of it, shall we?
I mean...
When that happens, and it does happen, and there are groovy people who want that to happen, but they're in the minority.
Yeah.
There's a few.
Definitely.
There's a few right-thinking, groovy people who go, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I spoke at Parliament a few weeks ago where I had cross-party agreement that Ofcom should regulate what goes on behind the scenes. But it feels like we're not being spoken to or we're being ignored, and I don't know why.
But it's the stories as well. It's this idea, like, even though, like, the Night Manager and Poldark and, dare I say, Broadchurch and stuff, this pastoral Britain sells abroad, that doesn't mean that you couldn't sell diverse stories that have, a core British kind of sensibility abroad. And I've had, serious arguments with people who said, especially after BBC Three closed and a lot of the money went into the drama, they were like, "Look, you got to understand that pastoral Britain sells in America." I'm like, "Great, that's fine. Night Manager sells in America." Like, stories that have a huge, Luther sells in America.
And,
like,
he has no black friends or family.
It's weird, right? It is so weird.
How weird is that? No, hey, listen, I love Idris. I think he's great. But Luther, case in point, a show with a charismatic black lead can sell abroad.
Yeah.
So that means that shows that are urban and contemporary, made now with a diverse cast, if written and produced correctly, could sell abroad. So if you think about it in terms of the financial imperative, which my producing partner is always talking about, there is a financial argument that says, we buy Pulp Fiction and Empire and we watch on cable Atlanta and Dear White People, and why wouldn't we be able to sell a British version of that to the world?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we create a format that shows a modern Britain to the rest of the world? We sell our sport.
Sell our music.
We sell our music.
But this is the whole thing. Even Stormzy.
Grime is huge in America.
But Stormzy literally, this has only happened like 2 weeks ago, right? Fucking Stormzy, His picture was put up when Romelu Lukaku was transferred to Manchester United, right? The guy's door got kicked down by the fucking police in Chelsea. Like, there is still, like, when I lived in New York for a year, and there is a feeling in New York, whether you're Puerto Rican, Haitian, Dominican, you can do what you want. You could literally do what you want. You want to be a banker? Great, make loads of money being a banker. You want to be a rapper? In this country, there is still huge oppositional. I'm just going to say it how it is. It's fucking racism.
It's a subtle sort of creeping, passive-aggressive racism. We think of America as an incredibly racist country because black people are being killed on the streets. But the racism you get here is the sort of racism that won't be said overtly, but will be sort of insinuated.
Well, that's the problem. And also people are scared to say it. What I think the black community in this country and the Asian community are scared to come out and say is that there's a insidious racism going on here. There's an institutional racism that's going on here. There are serious patriarchal blocks on advancement in social life in this country that are down to this imperialist racism. And there are serious things where, you know, if you look at the way, how weirdly, I was listening to the radio this morning where there are internet trolls, people trolling the Grenfell survivors because of what's happened post-Grenfell, people being given shelter, being given places to live while their housing is being sorted out, and people have been trolling them and saying, how dare you live in that? You know, I just think, there is a racism. But if you say that, you're accused of... There's a thing of you've got a chip on your shoulder and you need to knock that off. Yeah. And in this country, we don't have that attitude. Yeah. We all muck in together, don't we? But unfortunately, I think we do all muck in together, but some of us believe they are privileged to their position in life over others. And I think that's got to change. That's got to be evened out. And the reason why we're arguing about diversity and inclusion, it shouldn't even, you know... Diversity to me feels like a black person in a room with their head in their hands, trying to fight an enormous battle. Yeah. You know, diversity to me is like Jamie Lannister looking up in the sky and seeing this enormous fucking dragon coming towards him and going, oh shit.
It would be that crazy. The way Jamie looked at that dragon would basically be like, anyway, everyone looked at him, suddenly there was a black prime minister to be like, I've never seen one of these before.
It was like that.
I can't believe we brought Game of Thrones.
But the thing is, when they appointed Sharon White as the boss of Ofcom, people of colour and people of every ethnicity thought, fantastic. It's a woman. She's black. Surely now we're going to see some stuff happen that's going to be good for all of us. She's a woman. She's very, very intelligent. She's got great sensibilities with regard to how things should change in the industry. But she's not being criticised for doing her job. She's actually being criticised for not doing her job enough. So to acknowledge that the BBC must do something about diversity to make sure that it's in the charter, good. To not regulate that the BBC... look at and address the lack of diversity behind the camera is a misstep, and she must correct it. And that's basically what the diversity argument is.
Very good. Shall we move on to our dessert?
Let's talk about it. Do you like a good dessert?
I love a good dessert.
What would be like your favorite top dessert? 10 or not top 10? Let's go.
Desserts.
Yeah,
I like apple pie. Apple crumble and custard.
Classic.
So he's more like on your side.
Classic.
I think.
Yeah, I'm more
we
like.
Do this sort of. I love a creme brulee, basically, because my mum used to let me use like a mini blowtorch.
Nice.
Yeah.
But he's more of a sort of
bread and butter pudding.
Junior arsonist.
Yeah.
Junior arsonist. Weird that's
I like
why
the cut
he
of
likes
your mum's gin.
The creme brulee, just so he could use the blowtorch.
So what have you brought us for our metaphorical dessert, Lenny?
I've forgotten. We've talked about. We've sort of.
We've touched on it.
I think we were going to talk about diversity. We talked about theatre and why theatre is important. And basically we said that it's about representation. It's also a really good way to take in points of view. You know, they say that you can't know something unless you walk a mile in someone else's shoes. Well, going to see a play is sort of that personified, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so for me to go and see... seven and a half hours of Angels in America, or
yeah, you've just done that, right?
Or two and a half.
Tell people about it who might not, because a lot of people never have heard of that play.
Well, you can get it on video. Angels in America is a sort of a state of the nation play that was written at the time of the HIV epidemic, which is compared by Tony Kushner, the author, basically to a plague, like the bubonic plague that was wiping out vast swathes of the gay community and straight community in America and in the world. And it was trying to put people in the place of the people that were going through this. It was the gay community, it was the straight community, it was the closeted gay community, it was the wives of, you know, it was all sorts of people. And it's incredibly moving. And what's great about it is that if you're straight and you're watching it, you're thinking, oh my God, this happened in my lifetime. If you're gay, you're sitting there going, this happened to people I know. I mean, if you're straight, it happened to people you knew.
Yeah.
So it was an incredible, immense, immersive experience. But theatre does that to you. And so that was my point about theatre. It was that it should be for all of us, and it should start when you're a kid. It should be driven into you when you're a little kid that theatre is going to be an important companion for you, and you should utilise it.
I've been reading Sapiens again recently. Have you heard of this book?
No.
It's Yuval Noah Harari. And what he's talking about in Sapiens is basically the power of narrative generally. Like, you know, we're sitting in a country called England. It's part of a greater amount of countries called Great Britain, which is just a story. It's just a narrative.
Yeah,
we just live in a story. And it's like,
well, think about sci-fi. Everything totally that we now have in terms of tech was dreamed up 20, 30 years ago.
Gene Roddenberry.
Arthur C. Clarke.
Hey, we have to be careful because if you think about things like The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah. Oh my God, what a show.
When somebody writes a dystopian
society, if you look at Blade Runner.
There are a lot more of them now.
And Minority Report. Yeah. If you think about what authors are writing about now, and if you think about this idea of America being 10 years ahead of us,
yeah,
we have to be very careful about our future. We have to protect our future. What do we want our future to be?
But I think this comes back to what Hayde said about actually, like, even though they're, listen, it's great that we're applauding people for being slightly more political now, but just buying the t-shirt just ain't going to cut it. You ain't going to change things. Mm. But I think as storytellers, we've got a new kind of necessity. Like, I think
there's a bigger
Ricky
responsibility.
Gervais was saying that thing about how, and it is kind of true. It's like, after Trump, it's like the idiots have won. So he was like, just playing idiots doesn't make me feel so good anymore, because actually what I've realized is that they are venerated. And, you know, it's really funny because I was talking to someone about this the other day. It's like, you know, I've got to do this thing in a couple of weeks' time and talk to some teachers. And obviously they're getting cuts all over the time. And, you know, if you think about a teacher's job now, it's quite hard because, you know, we used to say things like, bullies never prosper. Now it's like, bullies become president of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's fucking weird, man.
So the next wave of millennial creators needs to think in terms of venerating smart people. It's like cherishing smarts, cherishing books, cherishing cleverness, encouraging cleverness, so that we don't live in a culture that venerates idiots and bullies.
Mm.
We venerate people that are smart, that think about
and
things.
And your diversity point as well, and also sexism, having more female protagonists. You know, I guess if Star Trek gave us those slidey doors on Virgin trains, Perhaps if we write more female protagonists and black protagonists, people from black communities or women might feel that they can be, you know, grow up to be prime minister or grow up to be, you know.
Well, the thing is, we had Obama, and how interesting. And clearly, Obama did not achieve what he thought he was going to achieve.
Well, I mean, that's an understatement, isn't it? Because, I mean, in a lot of ways, factually, without Obama, there's no Trump, which is a crazy reality.
Well, Trump is a reaction to Obama, right? So we have to think in terms of, okay, did we blow our chance with Obama? You know, America must be thinking, we blew it, we blew it, we had a brilliant president, we blew it. So the next time we get an Obama type, wherever he's from, whether he's white or gay or he's...
Or just his wife.
Or just his wife.
Well, Michelle,
When Michelle runs,
she will.
We need to not blow it.
Yeah. She will, though. She will run.
Yeah. Michelle, please run.
She's going to run. She's more popular than he is.
Yeah. So when Michelle runs,
she is fact.
We need to not blow it.
Yeah.
Because Michelle is...
Well, how do you think we blew it with the bomb?
Well, he was too pragmatic, though, wasn't he?
In what way do you think we blew it? Do you think he...
They didn't support him.
Have you read Dreams of
a lot of people... No.
Like his book. No. So basically, the thing that I... So my dad read it, and this was when he was in the running, and I was... I thought Hillary was going to win. I'm talking like right at the beginning, before, you know, when no one knew who he was and suddenly he appeared out of nowhere. And what you get from the book is that the man is a pragmatist, right? Like, he is pragmatic, like that. He is loyally, like that is his thing. That's how he works. He was never like a super impassioned demagogue of any kind. He was never going to kind of like rally people in this way. But the thing is that actually to fight a lot of the prejudice. So we went around America in, I guess, 2014, and we went to everywhere you'd never want to go. So we were filming in like Alabama, Phoenix, private prisons. And this is for the third series of our show. And I was absolutely terrified of America when I came back from there, because like you started seeing this kind of, and you know that old phrase, like the devil will always have a cup of tea with you, or whatever. It's kind of like I met, you know, mad fucking pro-lifers in Texas, ridiculous racists in places that, you know, outside Dallas that I found. I mean, I personally, you were in Alabama.
I was with the Ku Klux Klan in Alabama for an afternoon, but playing like a racist Ithilican.
But you know what I mean? It was like, for me, it was like, you know, to change the way these people think is almost impossible in my mind.
We're coming back to comedy and it as a tool and its uses. Mm. And when you came back from that experience, and I often think this when I watch Louis Theroux, I often think, did you achieve, was the point to show these people the way they are and to kind of go, look, this is how they are. Oh my God, isn't it scary? Was the point to take their piss? Was the point to say, these people are ridiculous. It's ridiculous to be this extreme. Because when you're my thing, and because I'm visibly different from you, my thing, I couldn't do that kind of exercise. I couldn't go and sit and talk to someone from the Ku Klux Klan because I'd get killed. There's a precedent for that. Yeah. Your advantage is that you look like them.
We use white
privilege. So you can sit amongst them and you can get them to say things that they wouldn't say in normal conversation. I couldn't do that. But what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is that there's a time to just say what you want to say and go, you know what? I'm not going to go and interview the guy from the Ku Klux Klan. I'm going to talk for 10 minutes in a very smart way about how we can fight back.
I agree.
And here's five things we can do that's going to stop the anti-Muslim or the anti-racist or the anti-truth brigade. Here's some things we can do. Because when we pretend to be the thing that we're against, what happens is the people that we're against go, great. You're saying what we say.
You see, Lenny, I think this is very...
And I'm just thinking then that's probably something that needs to change.
I think you're right. And I think this was five years ago. This was actually a different time. And I think you're totally right. And I've actually been feeling this in terms of our comedy recently. I'm when I'm not doing stuff with him or other people on you know, pitching to BBC or Channel 4, I'm just doing stuff online like I used to do before I did any TV stuff that was much more renegade and actually like verging on the lines of, you know, well,
illegal.
Whatever. Yeah, but like really just trying to stick it to people, because I think it is a completely different time right now. And just as an example of that, when we went to Alabama, it was actually very hard back then, this is 5 years
so
ago,
true.
To find anyone that was remotely associated with the Ku Klux Klan. Now it's everywhere. It's open now. And like people who are white supremacists are out there saying they support Trump, having protests in Washington.
Yeah.
Like it's
giving things, it a fucking hell Hitler salute.
Yeah. Things,
crazy
things
shit.
Have really changed. And I think, look, going back to the Obama point, this is, I think, the paradox, and it's what is the strength of liberals or sort of left-leaning people like us, lovely people like us, is the strength and their weakness is both that they're, you know, pragmatic and open-minded and willing to accept everyone's opinion and try to negotiate some kind of compromise between everyone, but that's also their weakness. And people say this about Obama with all sorts of things, especially with healthcare. They're like, look, he tried to bring in the Republicans, he wanted consensus, but that was also his great strength. And I think it's dangerous to... politically to abandon that, because that is what makes it great, being a Democrat, being someone who's liberal. But it's also...
check this. He was clever. He was smart. He was on paper he looked, he was, his rhetoric was brilliant. He was, he united people, and it didn't work. You know, you know, in many respects, Obama is seen as a missed opportunity. And you think, well, if Obama can be seen as a failure, what hope is there?
Do you know what? Gary Young, who's a Guardian journalist, I love him as well. Yes. He gave me a lot of hope. I watched a sort of video that he did, and it's very true. Like, in the context of American history, there has always been like a huge pendulum swing. So when big changes happened, for instance, like after the slave trade was kind of outlawed, you had the Jim Crow, the sort of Jim Crow laws, where, you know, essentially, you know, people couldn't just take it. They, you know, there was just like, how dare there be equality? How dare you call, you know, these people who have literally been picking cotton for us and we could whip and rape their wives and, you know, basically do what the fuck we wanted to them. How can you call them people? So what we'll do is we'll basically make them sure that they're not people. You know, after Selma, you know, there was huge regressive kind of reaction to, you know, so many white people coming into town saying, no, we're standing with these people. Like, we are actually going to stand as one people. And I think that, you know, in that context, if you look at Obama as a pendulum swing one way, as Trump as a swing the other way, you know, I mean, it is true that, you know, not just the Women's March, but, you know, there's this phrase that's become like, you know, in America, like, protest is the new brunch. You know, there's certainly kind of like a resistance that has kind of started to kind of coagulate around kind of California, particularly in sort of more liberal centers. Because, you know, it's not just, you know, Trump's and Steve Bannon's dislike of, you know, blacks or sort of ethnic minorities or women. You know, it's Jews as well. You know, it's fucking, you know, it seems to be pretty much everyone who's not that kind of angry, anglicized kind of, you know, a white working class American.
I think what you're saying is true. And what I noticed, I was in New York and LA recently, and I think that what people are have been encouraged to is to speak up. And I think the hope that you were talking about is that this upsurge in this country of people going, I'm going to speak my mind and I'm going to vote my protest, is an advance. And I think in America, people have woken up. There's this whole, the black expression, stay woke.
Yeah, woke.
Yeah, you woke now?
Oh my God, you are woke.
You are woke. And what's happened is, it's shit's getting real. Yeah. And people are going, oh my God, if we don't use our vote, if we don't use our intelligence, if we don't use our judgment, this is what happened. Yeah. We were not awake and now we are woke. Because this is what happens when you're slightly sleeping on an issue. When you slightly vote not to spend another £2 on the cladding on the building because it's an extra £2, exactly. People fucking die. Yeah. When you slightly go, oh, I'm not going to vote, you know, what's going to, what, they're going to vote Trump in? You wake up the next day and they voted him in. When you slightly don't worry about the NHS.
No, it's true, there was complacency.
They steal it from you.
Me.
We were
so
complacent.
So now, what's great about drama, what's happening in theatre, what's happening on the telly, what's happening in movies, people, artists are going, Christ, look what's happened. And they're trying to make art that's going, wake up.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's good for us.
Lenny, thank you so much, man.
Peace.
Thanks, Lenny.
Bye.
Bye.